Yes, hi, my name is Shadman Bashir, and I'll be the moderator for this session. And unfortunately, the third gentleman is not here, so hopefully he'll join us soon. I teach law at Dixie State University, and I just drove in from Vegas. So if I'm a little bit out of focus, that's the long drive. So let me, without wasting time, let me introduce the gentleman from Turkey, Lami Bertan Takazulu, Assistant Professor at University Law School from Turkey. Second gentleman is going to be Kishan Manucha. He's a lecturer at University of East London School of Law. So Professor Ferrari, still not here. He teaches law at University of Insubria, Italy. So we'll wait for him, see if he shows up. In the meantime, let's start with Professor Takazulu.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. I know it's very late and everybody's tired. I'll try to make things clear and keep it as short as possible. So I come from Turkey. I have a legal background, so I'm a constitutional lawyer. And I'm going to talk about secularism and religious institutions in Turkey. But it is quite a turbulent area in Turkish law. It's developing every day. And Turkey is a state that experiences polarization and high tension between seculars and religious groups, as well as religious groups between religious groups themselves as well. So this is also reflected into the institutional structure, how the religious institutions operate. And I will try to reflect upon those issues today. And although the title of this session is Middle East and Africa, I will be focusing on standards developed under the European systems, since Turkey is part of Europe. Our law is based on Europe, though nowadays it's behaving more like a Middle Eastern state, so I don't think it's really totally incorrect for me to be invited to this session. What I will do is I will first talk about two prevailing models in European countries today, my observations about that. Then I will touch upon the evolution of Turkish religious institutions to be able to show you where this existing structure comes from and where we are heading. And then I will assess the Turkish religious institutions under the European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence. So what I will do is I will ask basic four questions about the religious institution structure under the ECHR jurisprudence and try to show you how Turkey responds to those questions. In fact, my paper is also proposing a model, but I think that will be too detailed for this session. So if you ask questions about that, I can also elaborate on this. So the first topic is the models. From an institutional perspective, I observe that the European societies have adopted two models in setting up their religious institutions. They are not country-specific models. It could be both models adopted by a same country, in the same country, as we will see in the case of Austria. But there are two types of religious institutions, and they determine the relationship of these institutions with the state. So the first model considers religious services as a public service and grants a public law entity status to religious organizations. For instance, this is the case in Germany. German constitution explicitly makes a reference to public law entities of the religious institutions. In these countries, religious organizations enjoy the benefits of extensive powers arising from the public entity status, such as receiving tax revenues or financial support from the state, employing staff with a public servant status, establishing their own schools. So they have extensive powers. The drawback, however, is that despite having an autonomous status from the state, In these countries, states have closer supervision powers and channels of interference with the affairs of these public law entities. So although they have more powers, they are supervised and controlled closely by states. But I have to reserve that they're all autonomous, because they have to be autonomous. As we will see, the European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence requires them to be autonomous. And the second model is based on the establishment of a sui generis private law entity. These are not public law entities. In Austria, for example, there is a federal law concerning the legal status of confessional communities, which contain a sui generis private law entity status. These religious organizations do not receive as much support from the state, and their powers are rather limited compared to the public law entities in countries like Germany. However, in return, they enjoy a broader autonomy. So when the state does not support them and grant them extensive rights, does not feel like controlling that much. So the European states are not alone in crafting standards for setting up such religious institutional frameworks, as the European Court of Human Rights have been involved in shaping up those norms through its jurisprudence, especially on Article 9, freedom of religion, and Article 11, on freedom of assembly. And I think these are important because the court's jurisprudence represents the consensus among Council of Europe member states. So that's why I think this is important to focus on, and I will be focusing on that in the third chapter. So secondly, I will focus on the evolution of Turkish religious institutions. This is very important to see where we are. We should start from the Ottoman Empire here. It was for sure that the Ottoman Empire was a theocratic state based on the norms of Islam. And Islamic religious authority was represented by Sheikhul Islam, so-called Sheikhul Islam, who had considerable administrative and financial autonomy until the 19th century. Such autonomy, however, was lifted by Mahmud II in the 19th century, who was a centralist reformist. Mahmud transferred Sheikhul Islam into the government by establishing a ministry of religion. And therefore, the religious authority lost its fatwa independence. I think this is important because the habit or the practice of controlling religion starts from the Mahmud II's era. That's how he started to control religious authority. On the other hand, it's also important to focus on the minorities in the Ottoman time. The Christian and Jewish minorities enjoyed broad autonomy during the Ottoman era under the millet system, to such an extent that religious minorities of modern Turkey cannot even dream of today. When the empire collapsed at the beginning of the 20th century, the minorities, the recognized minorities in the empire, had their own constitutions, they had their own legislative assemblies, they had their own courts. This cannot even be dreamed of today by the minorities in Turkey. And after the collapse of the empire in 1920s, the first revolutionary government initially maintained the Ottoman structure and established a Ministry of Religious Affairs in 1920. However, right after this, in 1924, the caliphate was dissolved, and the secularist tendency started to show itself. And as a result, the institutional framework that is the basis of the framework today was established. The Kemalists believed that the state had to control religion, as we talked about the French system, how it influenced the societies. Turkey is one of them. However, this perspective is also reflected into the Constitutional Court's jurisprudence in Turkey today. You will see it in all cases concerning the principle of secularism. Kemalists believe that state had to control religion, especially in a country with an Islamic majority, as the rules of Islam had a comprehensive coverage of state affairs, and according to them, if the state did not control religion, Islam would inevitably start to control the state. Therefore, the Ministry of Religious Affairs was downgraded to a Directorate of Religious Affairs under the Prime Ministry. It was hoped that such framework would prevent religion from becoming a political issue, but the state would still be able to control the majority religion. So they didn't want it to be politicized, so they didn't want it to remain as a ministry, but as a director, under secretary or a directorate, which is connected to the prime ministry. This perspective was based on the presumption that the rulers of the Turkish state would always have a secular perspective, which we now know was a miscalculation. Such controlling powers created an environment that is conducive to giving more and more prevalence to Islam in state affairs, while creating such a powerful structure for the majority religion. The Kemalists followed a rather hesitant approach for granting rights to religious minorities, possibly as a reaction to the role these minorities played in the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. So there is also, I think this is important to note, why Turkey has been so hesitant in granting rights to minorities. It's because, especially during the collapse of the empire in the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire tried to unify all of its dependents by granting rights. Especially the minorities benefited those rights at that time, but it still did not stop the dissolution and the collapse of the empire. So that's why it was quite an ironic experience that the reformers, revolutionary reformers of the new republic, established the new state on this experience. So they were allergic to, minority rights. Okay, the third title that I want to touch upon is the assessment of Turkish religious institutions under the ECHR jurisprudence. There are very simple questions, and there are simple answers, actually, but unfortunately today we cannot talk about them in Turkey easily without being under threat. So the first one, is there a responsibility to grant an entity status to religious groups? When we look at the ECHR jurisprudence, there is well-settled case law on this. For instance, there's a recent case on Church of Scientology of St. Petersburg versus Russia in 2014, actually. They complained about the authorities' refusal to register Scientology group as a legal entity. And here the court repeated its established case law, stating that the ability to establish a legal entity in order to act collectively is in a field of mutual interest was one of the most important aspects of freedom of association under Article 11. Moreover, there is also a freedom of religion aspect of the story. Where the organization of a religious community has been an issue, a refusal to recognize it as a legal entity has also been found as as an interference with the freedom of religion under Article 9. I also have to add that the court has consistently stated that such entity must enjoy an autonomous status. There are two cases, very interesting, against Bulgaria, where the Bulgarian government intervened with the election process of the religions, both for the minority Muslim minority religious elections and also the majority religion. In both cases, the European Court found violations on Article 9 and 11. So they have to be autonomous. Looking at the panorama in Turkey, Turkey has a rather fragmented practice in this respect. None of the religious communities have an entity under the Turkish law, including the majority religion. So the Directorate of Religious Affairs is connected to the state, but it doesn't enjoy an entity status. And I have to add that freedom of religion is only regulated as an individual right in the constitution. There is no reference to the collective side aspect of this right. Although in a recent judgment, the Turkish Constitutional Court made a reference to the collective side. However, we will see how it will develop because it doesn't reflect the text of the constitution. And as I said, the majority religion is represented by the Directorate of Religious Affairs, which is a constitutional body. There is a separate article on that. and it's under the hierarchy or of the prime ministry. The organs are appointed by the government. They can be expelled, dismissed by the government as well. So there's zero autonomy there. Secondly, there's a second category. These are the religious communities which belong to the minorities that are recognized under the Lausanne Convention of 1923. Since this convention does not explicitly address to the associations of these religious minorities, they have not been allowed to establish religious entities. These are the Greek Orthodox Church, Armenian Orthodox Church, and the Jewish Rabbi. They are recognized as minorities. However, they are not allowed to establish an entity with a representative power. This assessment actually has been confirmed by a recent judgment of the Court of Appeals of Turkey in 2007. This was a case involving the Greek Orthodox Patriarch, and the Turkish Court of Appeals said the Patriarch does not have an entity status, and it does not even have a representative status. So you may ask, what does it do? What's the function of this important patriarch? That's a big question mark. And a third category is those religious groups other than these that I listed, the officially recognized minorities, the majority religion, but there are others, new actors, so to say, such as Protestant Christians, Buddhists, and like the Mormon Church. They are not represented at all. The only thing they can do is to establish a basic association or a foundation, which is in fact not crafted for religious purposes. Until recently, that was not possible either. You could not establish an association for religious purposes, or you could not be able to establish a foundation for these purposes. Those associations and foundations were often shut down by courts in Turkey. I also have to add that these groups, none of these groups have any sort of autonomy. So Turkish system does not comply with the ECHR jurisprudence on this. The second question is how to decide whether a group is a religious group or not. Which one are we going to protect? The European Court does not favor an exhaustive definition of religion, and it considers that it's not its duty to impose states parties' abstract definitions of religion. However, in a case called Kimliya and others versus Russia, the court discussed this matter with regard to the Church of Scientology. And the analysis is quite interesting from a legal point of view. It applied the European consensus standard, which is a comparative law method. What the court did was look at the other member states' practices. If there is any consensus in accepting, recognizing Scientology as a religion, then it said, I would not allow you to depart from this consensus. However, when it looked at this situation, it found out that in some states like Spain and Portugal, it was recognized as a religious group, but in Belgium and France, Germany, UK, it was not. So there was no consensus, and it concluded that the Russian authorities could enjoy a broad margin of appreciation because there was no consensus on the definition. However, assessment did not end there, which is more important for us in Turkey. It followed that it also assessed how the Russian authorities used their discretionary powers. So it looked into the matter and said, since the Surgut Center of Scientology was treated as a religious entity, the Russian authorities should grant a religious entity status, a religious group status to this one. This was because this Surgut Center of Scientology was shut down because it was involved in religious activities. So this here, this part of this analysis really is linked to Turkey because we have many similar cases. Turkey shows considerable resistance against recognizing religious groups. For instance, non-Muslim communities such as the Armenian, Jewish, Greek communities, and even Jehovah Witnesses are not recognized as part of religious groups. And Alevites and Baha'is, part of the religious Islamic groups, they are not also considered as religious groups. However, if you look at the court practice in Turkey, as I said, it was not possible to establish foundations or associations for religious purposes before. And these groups used to set up, establish religious associations, and they were all shut down by Turkish courts. So they were treated as religious groups. So looking into the jurisprudence of the European Court, we can easily conclude they should all be recognized as religious groups. The third question, what happens if a religious group is divided? Are states supposed to recognize these fragments individually? This is an interesting question, and it came up before the European Court in Metropolitan Church of Bessarabia and others versus Moldova case, which is also a recent case. In this case, the court said one single administrative authority, administration, cannot be imposed on a religious group, on a divided group, even if the religion is identical. Because the Moldovan Orthodox Church, the Bessarabian Church, was the belief and the practices were completely identical to the Roman Church. And that's why the Moldovan authorities said, this is a problem within yourselves, don't get us involved, we are not going to give you another entity status. And they were refused. And in this case, the European Court said, single authority cannot be imposed, single leadership cannot be imposed. And the second important assessment here was that if there are establishment of a separate entity, religious entity, cannot be made subject to approval from another religious group. So this is also important, which we have in Turkey. For instance, the Alevites, they are considered to be Muslims. They want to establish their own religious prayer houses, gathering houses. They don't want to go to mosque. However, the Directorate of Religious Affairs does not allow them to be accepted as an independent religious entity. So they cannot move on. So this is clearly contrary to the jurisprudence in the Metropolitan Orthodox Church case. And finally, is it possible for states to apply different norms to different religious groups? Because we have a multi-speed approach in Turkey, a fragmented approach. And this issue came up before the European Court in the Jehovah Witnesses case versus Austria in 2008. And the Austrian system was questioned here. It was very fragmented, just like the case in Turkey. While the Roman Catholic Church had a powerful public law entity status, as I said before, the Austria had passed a federal law concerning the legal status of confessional communities in 1998. This law provided a civil law entity status, a sui generis civil law entity status. It did not contain all those powers granted to the majority religion. So there was a big difference between the powers granted to the majority religion, the public entity status, and the civil law entity status, which was actually provided to Jehovah Witnesses. And the European Court found a violation here because it made a comparison between the powers of these two statuses, and the powers were quite different. The court said, although having the possibility of establishing a civil law entity reduces the impact of the treatment and intervention, the gap between the powers of the two types of entities in question was too big to be justified. So what you do as a state, if you create a very powerful entity for the majority religion, and you only allow the minority religions to have a weak civil law entity status, then this is not acceptable. This is a violation of Article 9. And when we look at the case in Turkey, the Directorate of Religious Affairs, which is the Sunni Islam-dominated body, receives vast sources from the state budget. The budget has been raised approximately six times since 2003. And just to give you a clue, the budget is four times more than the Ministry of Culture. two times more than the Ministry of Interior. This money is tax money and everybody pays, no matter what religion you're affiliated with. And the money only flows to the Sunni Islam at the moment. So there is a big gap between the public law, though it's not entity, but it's a public law body, and the other religious groups who are only allowed to establish associations or foundations, and the state has no support for those. That's why I think as the law stands, Turkish practice does not reflect, does not comply with the European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence. And as I said, we can talk about the model, ideal model that I think which would be applicable for Turkey if you ask questions. Thank you for listening to me patiently.
Thank you very much, Professor Takaslu. Now we'll invite Professor Ferrari. He's going to speak for 20 minutes, and then after that we'll have questions and answers after Professor. Okay.
Good afternoon. I came from Italy, so I'm a legal scholar, and I start immediately not to waste my 20 minutes. The opinion that religious freedom as a sort of black hole, a sort of an unknown land of lions, a no freedom area, where it has never born and never will take root, and that this place is the Muslim side of Mediterranean, seems to be today quite widespread. It is for this reason, and because what is currently happening in this part of the world, that I think that we can't only settle for rigid statistics that inevitably represent Muslim countries as lands of discrimination, and that it is crucial to try to draft an interconnected history of this freedom, able to observe commonalities and divergences without forgetting the complexity of the topic. Only insisting on minority persecutions or on Islamophobia, putting these and other phenomena under the same always larger but also increasingly vague umbrella of the right to religious freedom, it is not worth. What I would like to propose here is a larger framework able to offer a brief comparative view about Europe and Mediterranean Islam, too long considered as incommensurable realities. A comparative insight into the role of religious freedom in the two sides of Mediterranean depends on many factors, but above all on the fact that religious freedom has always been connected with political power, and it has become with the time a right to religious freedom, controlled by a strong political actor, the state. Like the Hag Humpty Dumpty of Lewis Carroll, the state, using the formula right to religious freedoms, I quote from Lewis Carroll, means just what it chooses it to mean, neither more nor less. In these 20 minutes, I would like to briefly describe what is happening in the northern and the southern sides, to conclude with the presentation of a model that seems to me work for both of them. So, what is the European situation? In Europe, we could say that there is today more right to religious freedom than, let's call, religious freedom. That means that religious freedom is, first of all, a state-centered concept and a tool that mainly aims at the social cohesion and security of the national apparatus. The good individual freedom of choice of native European citizens has become a centripetal menace to social cohesion when practiced also by new religions, and namely in Islam, perceived as antagonistic, particularly pervasive and cohesive nomoi groups. Starting from the assumption that religious freedom is primarily a matter of individual conscience, the European right to religious freedom appears today folded to the so-called forum internum. The result is a strong resistance to all reasonable accommodations, perceived as contrary to the neutrality of the public space. But as all of you know very well, state neutrality is grounded in history, and it does not affect deep state's preferences. Equality claims, for example, are not able of seriously questioning establishment systems. And even the reference by minorities, individuals or groups, to the right to religious freedom will have to face the umpty-dumpty state, which will select the subject able to invoke it. Consequently, despite the assertion that pluralism depends on the freedom of thought, conscience, and religions, its relationship with the right to religious freedom seems of inverse proportionality. More pluralism has increased, passing from the book to action, more the right to religious freedom has decreased, passing from action to the book. Moreover, pluralism in action has reactivated identity fears that slipped into the legal systems and conditioned the interpretation of constitutional principles and rights. The principle of constitutional secularism, the laïcité, for example, moving away from its genetic inclusiveness, is crushed on a very specific cultural identity narrative, becoming a symbol and an instrument of an exclusivist historical grounded public order against centrifugal forces endangering social cohesion. The result risks being the opposite of what was suggested by the Strasbourg court in its decision Serif versus Greece, where the Strasbourg court, considering tensions, unavoidable consequences of pluralism, asked the public authority not to remove the cause of tension by eliminating pluralism, but to ensure that the competing groups tolerate each other. The southern side. And some comparison. The south side of Mediterranean seems to offer the vision of a reversed mirror, with an identical shape of the northern model, but reflecting opposite starting points and different trends. First of all, the identical shapes of the mirror, a political arena monopolized by different and strong national states and apparatuses that are facing the effects of a wide individualization and secularization of a developed and skilled civil society. On the contrary than in the northern side, where conservative pressures invoke the end of multiculturalism, in southern side, the bottom-up pressure is often invoking a deep political change and more pluralism. While the North, the neutrality of the state law has been unmasked, in the South, the Islamic, or better, the Sharaitic character of the state has revealed its ambiguities. Like neutrality has shoved its cultural and religious roots, the Islamic character has shoved its state-oriented, strictly political and non-religious feature. This public debate about the religious legitimacy of the states are obliged to take into account the inescapable intra-Muslim pluralism, always perceived with a sense of irremediable guilty, and it also obliged to take into account the differentiation between political and religious, always experienced with embarrass from the Umayyad time and the Muslim court of the Abbasid Empire. The Egyptian and the Tunisian case are, at this regard, very instructive. Egypt illustrates very well both the secular use of Sharia by the state and the failure of the attempt to interpret this reference in a more confessional way. Tunisia illustrates the inability of Sharia to unify the political arena and the consequent choice to leave it outside of the institutional field. Both situations reveal, on one hand, the impossibility for constitutional Sharia to keep a unifying role in the future, and on the other, the pressure toward a more accentuated differentiation, already sketched in Egypt itself by the more independent and scientific role given al-Azhar by the 2014 constitution. In other words, constitutional Sharia brings frustration, nourishing dangerous expectations, both on the state and in religious side. The waiver of legalistic form of religious legitimacy inevitably poses the question of a common citizenship and a more impartial state and consequently a different right to religious freedom, imposing a strong revision of personal status. In this time, personal status is a strongly disputed matter in both sides of the Mediterranean. In both sides, the question of the personal status concerns the borders of the state normativity in relation to religious and cultural normativity. In the northern side is the opening of legal state system to religious normativity that is at stake. In the south, the pressure is to an opposite direction. Here, the overcoming of a rigid personal status is at the center of the concern both of women and young people that aspire to a common secular legal status and of religious minorities that aspire the state take charge of their concerns, also in matter of religious freedom. After the Arab Springs, despite the fears of two majoritarian Muslim democracies, Christian churches, more than defending their own isolated status, have started to ask a common right to religious freedom. For example, during the draft of the present Egyptian constitution, the Coptic Church and other religious groups proposed to substitute the words Christian and Jewish of the Article 3 with non-Muslim, so to enlarge the protection to Baha'i, Buddhist, Quranist, and other groups. So now the model, what is the model and think about? I have to dissolve this suspense. The model is Tunisia. Here a wise inclusive form of historical religious legitimacy has been founded. The preamble and the Article 1st of the 2014 Constitution take charge of the religious legitimacy in a pluralistic cultural framework, assigning to God the role more of favorable spectator to the Constitution than that of ruler. At the same time, the Article 6 of the same text introduces two important novelties. First, the explicit recognition not only of the freedom of belief, we find that in other constitution of the MENA countries, but also the freedom of belief and conscience. And second, the recognition of practices without naming limits, in this way assuring forum externum the same constitutional degree of relevance than forum internum. And this is a novelty also in relation to the common drafting in the northern side. Finally, the word of the Tunisian constitutional compromise is in the Article 2 of the Constitution, that with a non-amendable formulation, states that Tunisia is a civil state that is based on citizenship, the will of the people, and the supremacy of law. The reference to the civil state, la Tunisie en état à caractère civil, Dawla Madania, has overcome the disputes about the religious or the secular legitimacy of the state. In particular, the reference to this civil character first strictly anchors state sovereignty to the popular will, like the secular principle, not impeding, second, the opening of civil society to religion, more clearly than the present interpretation of the secularity principle in Europe. By so doing, the reference to the civil character of the state seems to avoid the extreme interpretation possible for religious and secular form of state qualifications. It is the case of Egyptian Sharia, but it's also the case of the European secularism. Avoiding the involution of this latter, the Tunisian civil state seems also to highlight the will to avoid another effect of present securitarian European secularism, the incapacity to cope with cultural and religious pluralism. About this present difficulty of European secularism, it is worth noting that when the Turkish Prime Minister Turgut Özal attempted in the Haitis to relax the hard Kemalist laicite, he used as the rationale the need for Turkey to open its public space to encounter the European Union parameters. One decade later, Strasbourg Court endorsing the ban of the headscarf by Turkish authorities, legitimizing the approach used in 1979 by the Turkish Constitutional Court to stop the Özal reforms. So we wait a change. In this way, the state-centric European approach risks having little to say southern countries about pluralism and civil state, rather reassuring both the classic Turkish model and the positivistic state Sharaitic model, all convergent in ensuring state the monopoly of the religious field. The present political changes in the Mediterranean area should suggest more modesty to Europe on one side and the courage and the will to persevere in their path to the counter of the Mediterranean Islam. This change reveals finally alternative contemporaneities, among which Tunisia could be an interesting example for Europe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Ferrari. And now we invite Professor Kishan Manucha from UK to speak for 20 minutes. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, and very grateful for this invitation to be here at this annual symposium. I wanted to say a few words about a subject that's interested me greatly in recent years, which is how religious minorities can strive to retain their integrity in the wake of oppression, fierce opposition, persecution. And in doing so, to contribute, if you like, to the ongoing discussion, discourse on the role of religion in society when it is a time, of course, it is an issue of such great importance, whether it be in the Middle East or elsewhere. Because the case I would like to share with you is that of the Baha'i religious minority in Iran, which may or may not be familiar to you. Its situation, its plight in recent years may or may not be familiar to you also. In trying to explain and explore how certain elements of the Baha'i understanding or conception of religion underpins their approach to social change, which is intimately tied, connected to the response of the Baha'i community in Iran to a campaign of persecution. Now, as you may or may not know, the Baha'i community in Iran is the largest religious minority in Iran. It numbers around 350,000 individuals. The Baha'i faith comes from Iran. It was established in Iran in the middle of the 19th century by a nobleman by the name of Mirza Hussein Ali, who took the title Baha'u'llah, which in English means glory of God. It's a monotheistic religion. It's an independent global religion. And its social teachings include the full equality of the sexes, the elimination of extremes of wealth and poverty, the harmony of science and religion, the elimination of all forms of prejudice, and the need for universal education. The religion's most pivotal teachings, however, revolve around the promotion of unity and justice in the context of increasing global interdependence. One of the most noteworthy points to bear in mind or to know about the Baha'i faith is about the way it is organized. It's really essentially organized around a system of governing councils at the local, national, and international levels. These are democratically elected by the body of Baha'is residing at those various levels. Now, this mode of governance does not imply any political agenda, any kind of interference in the affairs of government. Indeed, Baha'is are required as an article of faith to refrain from involvement in partisan political activity and to show loyalty and obedience to the laws of the land in which they live. Yet, despite these very progressive, peace-inducing social teachings, the Baha'is in Iran have been the object of intense persecution ever since the emergence of the faith in the middle of the 19th century. More than 20,000 adherents have been put to death for their religious beliefs. Thousands upon thousands have lost their liberty. They've been subject to torture, other forms of violent assault. Their administrative order has been on more than one occasion closed down and has not been in existence since 1983. Their holy places, administrative and other community centers have been desecrated, closed down, homes vandalized, Baha'is expelled from higher education, expelled from their jobs in the public sector. So you could say that, in essence, the Baha'is have, as a non-recognized religious minority in Iran, been stripped of almost all their rights as citizens of the state of Iran. And I should also point out that the policy towards the Baha'is, the policy of persecution aimed at them, is enshrined in government policy in a document that was signed by the Supreme Leader in 1991 and which came to light in 1993 through the efforts of the then UN Special Rapporteur on Iran. Now, I'd like to say a few words about the Baha'i response to persecution. This should be, I think, understood as stemming from a conception of religion as a source of principles and values which, together with science, propels the advancement of civilization. The Baha'is understand religion to be a continually evolving system of knowledge and practice representing the spiritual experience of the human race. The Baha'i writings proclaim, and here's a quote, all men have been created to carry forward an ever-advancing civilization, and that the aim of every religion is to effect a transformation in the whole character of mankind, a transformation that shall affect both its inner life and external conditions. So informed by this vision, religion is understood as a transformative power which can unlock human potential for the betterment of society. The Baha'i understanding of religion as a single evolving civilizing process is rooted in a broader conception of the course and direction of history. Humanity, the Baha'i writings explain, is approaching today the crowning stage in a millennia-long process which has brought it from its collective infancy to the threshold of maturity, a stage that will be marked by the oneness of humanity becoming the organizing principle of human affairs. Not unlike the individual who passes through the unsettled yet promising period of adolescence, during which latent powers and capacities come to light, humanity in the Baha'i view is as a whole in the midst of an unprecedented transition. And behind so much of the turbulence of contemporary life are the fits and starts of humanity struggling to come of age. This process of transition is, of course, expected to take many generations to unfold. But informed by this understanding and by this vision, the Baha'i approach then to social change, including its response to persecution and other forms of oppression, is pursued, therefore, with a long-term perspective in mind and in a spirit of perseverance and patience. Baha'is see in the remarkable changes, the revolutionary changes taking place in every sphere of human life, the interaction of two fundamental processes. One is destructive in nature, while the other is integrative. Both serve to carry humanity, each in its own way, along the path toward its full maturity. I don't intend to dwell on the operational examples of the destructive and the positive integrative. I'm sure they are well known to you. But this particular understanding helps, if you like, the Baha'is to want to strive naturally and align themselves individually and collectively with the forces associated with the processes of integration in constructing viable alternatives of social order and new patterns of social integration. Now, for members of the Baha'i community, unity is not only one of the primary goals of social evolution, it is also the power through which these goals will be progressively realized. Indeed, in the Baha'i view, the principle that is to infuse all facets of organized life on the planet is the oneness of humankind, an acceptance of the common interests and common identity of mankind, as I said earlier, the hallmark of the age of maturity. But it's important just to point out that this pivotal principle of the Baha'i faith asks not merely for there to be a sense of goodwill amongst peoples, understanding, cooperation, although they're important, but it actually calls for a complete reconceptualization of the relationships that sustain society, relationships between and among individuals, between individuals and these institutions of governance, and between individuals and the community. So it regards humanity as an organic whole where members of the human family are fundamentally inseparable and interdependent parts of a larger creation. And hence, relationships between these three great protagonists in the civilizing process, individuals, institutions, and communities, need to be recast in this light, with implications in all realms of human activity, political, social, economic, and cultural. Now, this vision of unity as both the means and the end of social change is so fundamental to Baha'i belief that it characterizes the work of the community even in the face of violent oppression. Any approach to social change which seeks to pit one group against another, however indirect and however subtly, can never, in the Baha'i view, create the appropriate or necessary conditions for spiritual transformation and lasting change. Basically, what Baha'is see as one aspect of their contribution cannot contradict the other. They cannot be seeking to establish patterns of thought and action that give expression to the principle of oneness within their community and within wider society, yet at the same time engage in activities in another context, which to whatever extent reinforce an entirely different set of assumptions about human nature and social existence. Now, in addition to the collective commitment to the principle of the oneness of humanity, there are a number of other ideals and principles also relevant here. They include recognition of the spiritual and material dimensions of human reality, the cultivation of spiritual qualities and reliance on the power of personal example, the peaceful construction of viable alternative models of coexistence and cooperation, the principle of active service to others, regardless of their backgrounds and beliefs. So therefore, there is this focus on fostering values, principles, attitudes, and modes of behavior that are manifestations of a broadened horizon of human nature as the bedrock of contributing to social change. If you like, the Baha'i response then to persecution can be described as one of constructive resilience, rooted in striving to develop a pattern of life distinguished by adherence to the principles of the oneness of humanity and service to others. However, this posture of constructive resilience, together with the principle of obedience to the laws of the land, does not mean that Baha'is are forbidden from appealing for justice for themselves and other oppressed groups through the proper legal channels available to them. Indeed, they are directed and have pursued every principal means to defend themselves and others against oppression and to work for the empowerment of oppressed people everywhere. And they have an established history of advocacy and social action in this regard. In the case of the Baha'is of Iran, who are denied access to justice in their homeland, the worldwide Baha'i community has pursued over the last 35 years a strategy of shining a light on the situation in Iran to raise global awareness and appeal for justice within the emerging international framework of moral and legal norms. Now, I want to say a few words about the actual experience of Iran's Baha'i community, in the hope that it'll give a glimpse, if you like, into the efficacy of a distinctly non-adversarial, non-partisan, and constructive approach to social change. Take the field of education, for example. In the 1870s, individual Baha'is established a few modern schools in rural villages in northern Iran. And after the 1899 foundation of the Tarbiyat School of Tehran, the number of such schools multiplied exponentially across the country. As well as proving popular, Baha'i schools were the best academically. For instance, in a 1913 government examination, 30 of the 33 students of the Tarbiyat School passed, while only 10 of the 500 students from the other institutions of Tehran did so. Committed to the full principle, to the principle of the full equality of women and men, Baha'is founded the first school for girls in Iran, open to people of all faiths and backgrounds. Sadly, these schools were eventually shut down by the government during a particular episode of persecution in the 1930s. but they are nevertheless credited with training the first ever generation of professional women in Iran, leaving a lasting impact throughout Iranian society. Within the Baha'i community itself, Baha'i women in Iran under the age of 40 had achieved 100% literacy by 1970, compared to a national average of just 14%. Over the years, individual Baha'is have contributed significantly to such diverse fields as agriculture, health, and industry, all of which accrued to the benefit of the nation. In the face of mass denial of employment, high education, and other rights of citizenship since 1979, Baha'is have attempted to establish creative systems to ensure their survival. For example, some Baha'i entrepreneurs, despite attempts by various antagonists to force them out of business, have been able to quietly maintain modest businesses. Iran's Baha'is have also established informal systems to care for elderly Baha'is who have lost their pensions and to educate Baha'i children who have been expelled from schools. And in response to the denial of higher education imposed on their youth by the Iranian authorities, the Baha'is established their own open university, the Baha'i Institute for Higher Education, in a process that was described in the New York Times as an elaborate act of self-preservation. It's important to point out that these and other efforts have not been purely inward-looking or focused merely on survival. In the face of deep hostility by the authorities, Baha'is have still sought to contribute to the development and well-being of their local communities. However, even these constructive acts of service have been attacked by the government. For example, nearly 100 Baha'is were arrested in Shiraz in 2006 for participating in teaching literacy to underprivileged children. Now, by persevering with a principled and constructive approach, even in the face of sustained and systematic persecution, the Baha'is have demonstrated the potential of a purely non-adversarial model of social change. Granted, the personal costs have been high for many Baha'is, but it is likely that the costs would have been much higher if the Baha'is had pursued a path of political resistance, opposition, and even non-violent civil disobedience, thereby alienating large segments of Iranian society by their own actions, providing the authorities with the pretext for a full-scale genocidal assault, and confusing global perceptions regarding their innocence. Moreover, the emotional and psychological resilience of Baha'is who've experienced trauma in Iran has been particularly noteworthy, as a number of recent studies have demonstrated. According to these studies, this resilience appears to be due, at least in part, to the strength and coherence of their inner beliefs, to the meaning, vision, and moral purpose their faith provides them, and their ability to maintain an internal locus of control over their moral and spiritual life. The situation and future of religious minorities in the Middle East and elsewhere is often analyzed through the prism of international legal norms and instruments, geopolitics, socioeconomics, historic and cultural issues, and a range of internal political dynamics in the states where minorities are persecuted. These are all important approaches that have their value in the ongoing discussions on religious minorities and issues of freedom of religion. However, it may also be useful to consider the possibility that at its heart, these challenges involve conceptions of religion and its role in society. Societies like Iran, in which religious minorities are persecuted often, see religion as an element of identity that separates them from non-believers. Religion is seen as static, literal, and dogmatic. Religion as conferring privilege, exclusive and final access to the truth. Religion whose role is to control and impose its ideals on others. Although clearly not sufficient to create the conditions for persecution, they are arguably necessary. Such a conception of religion stands in sharp contrast, of course, to the one discussed here, and which has, in the case of the Baha'i religious minority in Iran, demonstrated its power to motivate individuals and communities to attempt to contribute constructively to society, even under the bleakest of circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions and answers now. So if anyone has a question, please introduce yourself, your name, your country, and please speak slowly so if it's the translation, it can be done easily for them. And yes, sir.
My name is Bob Smith. Do I need to pause and wait for translation? Are we okay? Okay. My question is for Professor Bashir. You were referring to the...
That's me.
There we go. Thank you. My question has to do with the European Court of Human Rights. As you referred to the cases and the precedent that was established, my question is really whether you view that court as establishing precedent that the courts and the executive branches of government in Turkey should follow, and or whether you have a more narrow conception of what the impact of those cases should be.
Should I answer now? Okay. All right. Yeah, I think a European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence has been taken very seriously. I mean, if you look at the reform process in the last 15 years, Turkey has changed its constitution because of that many times with regard to the fundamental rights. And Turkish lawyers, Turkish academics follow them, these jurisprudence, very closely. So I think it does, and it's expected to have an impact on the practice. However, there are certain areas that the Turkish government has been very resistant. And unfortunately, freedom of religion is one of them. For example, having our religion is printed in our ID cards and that we have to show everywhere. And the European Court found a violation on that in 2010. It's been 4 years. There has been no response until so far. So to be clear, I do not expect, I mean, even if such a case is brought before the court, I do not expect an immediate response. But I also think that it cannot be totally disregarded because the civil society and many actors do follow those case law. And it has proved to be a very important tool for developing Turkish law until so far.
Any other question?
I can actually add one more thing there. For example, just to give you an example, the Alevites, for example, they were not part of the Turkish curriculum. You know, we have a religion course, which actually it's ethnic, it's ethics and religion course. They went to the European Court of Human Rights, arguing that they also this course, which is compulsory under the Turkish curriculum in the primary schools, is not impartial, it's not objective, so it doesn't comply with freedom of religion. The European Court found a violation of Protocol 1, freedom of education. And after that, they have changed the books. I mean, they have put some certain sections concerning the Alevites. Well, the discussions, debates did not end because it was the Sunnis who wrote about the Alevite sections. So still it was a debated area, but they did respond. But the topic I talked to you about today is a very fundamental thing. The structural mechanism is the basis for all the violations, and I think it is a really major thing to do to reform this the way I proposed. So this would face some challenge, some resistance.
Thank you, Professor Takazlu. We have another question. It's working, sir.
It's working. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Pasquale Nichino from the European University Institute. I'm also an adjunct professor here at BYU.
Sir, if you can slow a little bit.
Yes.
Speak a little bit slowly.
Perfect.
So they can translate.
So I will repeat it.
Okay, thank you.
Pasquale Nichino from the European University Institute, and I also serve as an adjunct professor here at BYU. I teach European law. My question is for Professor Alessandro Ferrari. Alessandro, I share your concerns and the way you theorize this kind of dialogue between the northern part and the southern part of Mediterranean. My question is how Tunisia, that you claim can be a model, can really be a model for the North Africa and the wider Middle East? I mean, has Tunisia really the possibility of being a model, or is rather an exception in that context? Thank you.
Probably in a context where all states are exception in relation to the other, in the sense that we are in an age where more than commonalities, we see also in the European side differences also in relation to Europe. European court, where the approach is more, the pressures are more bottom-up than top-down. So that is it's difficult to speak about a model in sense that a sort of normative model that can be imposed or followed. I use the word model just because I think that was a very smart way to sort out the questions of religious legitimacy. Was the only country, maybe Morocco has done something similar, but in a different way, where between the difficult choice between the laicite principle, many legal scholars that work at the Tunisian constitution was grounded in the principle laicite, so they are skilled in the French civil law system. But so between this pressure about laicite and the other concern of the majoritarian political party and about Sharia and so a strong religious legitimation, this civil state seemed to me very interesting, able to avoid what can be dangerous interpretations. You know, in Egypt, the problem has been resolved in an opposite way, in the sense that we had Sharia from 1970 and then reinforced in the 80s. But the role of Sharia was just to push away religious forces from the public side. So Sharia in Egyptian constitution had the same role than the separation law in 1905 in France, paradoxically. When Muslim Brothers arrived, their constitution, the famous Article 219, tried to keep the interpretation of Sharia in the constitutional court, but tried to impose a sort of religious interpretation of Sharia. So what happens? A sort of change of government, I use this politically correct term, and Sharia is still in the constitution, but we don't know what kind of interpretation we receive. We know that what interpretation it won't receive. No confessional interpretation, but an interpretation by the Constitutional Court. In this constitution, Constitutional Court is very strong in the sense that co-opt the members. So it has built just to avoid any external reference. Is composed by judges that are a very secular background. But what is dangerous when you keep Sharia in constitution? You find in many, in the Western literature, the concept that is good because in any case it's the state that controls Sharia. So it's just something formal. But you know, when Sharia is a goal of the constitution, someone can take this seriously. So someone would like maybe to make this constitutional reference something concrete. So, you know, when you keep that, there are some paradoxes like the ban of religious political parties. So I think Tunisia can be interesting not to focus on tired concepts. So secularism, laicite, so just to try to move And to focus on a wider perspective. And this is also maybe a little honest because show how religious are political forces, religion are part of this civil state, but without hidden or masked themselves behind slogans or symbolic words that today are meaningless maybe or are more difficult to understand them.
Any other question? Yes, Judge.
Mr. Machaka, I see that you're a lecturer with the International School of Law in Pakistan. Could I ask you, this isn't dealing with your issues, but could I ask you a question about Pakistan?
Sure.
A few months ago, at the invitation of Chief Justice Jalani, I went to Pakistan for a conference, international conference, and it was on the role of the courts to advance religious liberty, which was a striking topic, I thought. And then just shortly after that, the Supreme Court took on a very interesting big blasphemy case in which people were burning a Sikh temple. And he ruled. He wrote the opinion for the Supreme Court saying that blasphemy statutes don't just protect Islam, they protect all religions, which both of which I thought were very striking turning points, if they are turning points. Could you evaluate for us what that means in the broader context of Pakistan providing more religious liberty for the people of Pakistan?
Thank you. Yes, well, I'll try to answer that the best of my ability. Clearly, we know that the situation facing religious minorities in Pakistan is a very difficult one, to put it mildly. We hear, you know, from day to day about assaults on particularly the Christian minorities, but also rising tide of violence against a Sikh minority now in Pakistan. Of course, we have the discrimination, the persecution of the Ahmadi community enshrined in law. And over this period of time that these things have been worsening, the government has turned essentially a blind eye to it, and the situation is worsening. So these developments are quite remarkable, really. And whether they will stand the test of time, whether we're seeing a turning of the tide, so to speak, we're yet to see. The problem is going to be finding a way to create within Pakistan a culture of greater inclusivity, mutual understanding, respect and tolerance, which requires more than action by government, it requires more than action by the judiciary, it requires a cultural shift which many actors, including government, will need to play. I think the key actors in this, at the local level, at the level of the grassroots, well, there will be certainly the educational establishments and the schools, where there's still in the textbooks that are used to teach about the history of Pakistan, about the founding of that nation, distortions of fact, distortions of history, and the denigration of minorities in that country. So that is a huge area to be tackled. And also to deal with law enforcement officials and agents who turned a blind eye to religious violence constantly, who turn matters on their head so that the number of cases that we hear about of blasphemy, which have originated in land or other personal disputes, which have no religious element to them, are turned into those, are sort of distorted, and processes then will follow from there, and we've seen the appalling results of that. So just hoping that these recent developments are positive, they can be built upon, but one has to remain very skeptical because of the huge degree of animosity that exists up and down the country towards minorities?
Judge, if I can answer, I'm from Pakistan, so I grew up over there, and I've worked on this thing. So I was like, should I say it? Should I speak? I mean, I grew up, all my education is in Catholic schools in Peshawar, so the Catholic school was in between two of the largest mosques. In Peshawar, there was a Protestant church, the largest mosque, Catholic church, and then the very huge mosque. So we used to go and play cricket in the church, pray in the mosque and play cricket in the church. That's how we grew up. It was a different world. There's a Pakistan before 9/11, and then there's a Pakistan after 9/11. So the two, I mean, huge differences. 1979, things changed, and 9/11, it just drew those lines between communities. And when we talk about blasphemy, it's not just about minorities. It's about Muslims also over there. Like when I was growing up, I couldn't say Jesus, the word. I had to say Hazrat Isa, alayhi salam, which means Jesus Christ, peace be upon him. Because if I say Jesus, that is blasphemy. That's the kind of Pakistan I grew up in. So it's way more complicated, the way Professor rightly explained it. We can't put the blame on one group or another. There's so many external forces which fight their fight within Pakistan. The 1,400-year-old Sunni and Shia fight, it's still being fought in Pakistan by two of the very powerful countries in the world. I mean, I would not mention that because I guess it'll be being recorded, so I won't mention that. But off the mic, I can speak differently, but hopefully I'll explain certain things. Any other questions? And I know I wasn't supposed to explain to any. I'm the moderator, so I have to be. But I had so many energy drinks, I can hardly keep myself quiet. Yeah, I just drove from Vegas with energy drinks, so.
I think it's interesting that just a few years ago, Justice Jalani was here at one of these conferences and listened very carefully. And I hope it had some influence when he later became Chief Justice. At least it was enough that he encouraged his son to come to BYU, which he did, and graduated, and now is back in Lahore.
Well, the conference had influence on me, so I'm the only Muslim advisor over here, so that it influenced me. So, and I'm explaining to all whoever I meet how fun it is being here and the whole pluralism of religion and stuff. So, but again, hopefully we'll chit-chat regarding that. Any other questions? So we'll thank our three scholars. Thank you very much. Thank you.